Our guest today is one of the best male players to ever play in the state of Kentucky. And Charles, I'm just going to go over a couple things real quickly. You were a state high school champion. You went from there to become an NCAA doubles finalist. And you went on from there to become one of the top 50 ATP players in the world and reach the third round of the U.S. Open twice. Quite a set of accomplishments for a young man from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yep, very, very fortunate to have had a good run.
Yeah. Tell me, how did you get started playing?
Oh, wow. So let's think probably beginning of the tennis boom in this country in the early 1970s. And somehow, my mother was an acquaintance, kind of grown up a little bit with Marilyn Roof, who runs Louisville Indoor Tennis Club, Racquet Club today, has for decades.
Yeah.
I think this was as simple as she called my mother and said, "Hey, would your boys be interested in maybe playing tennis?" And so my mother played a little tennis when she was a kid and always loved it. And she was never a fan of football. We had been playing some baseball. And so she said, "Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love for my kids to play tennis." And frankly, it all kind of started there with,
What age was that?
I think at the time I was 7 and I had a brother that played and he was maybe 9.
You know, you mentioned your brother, and when I coached at Kentucky, we competed against your brother when he was the team captain for Harvard. So he was quite an accomplished player in his own right.
Yeah, we ended up going, you know, full Monty on the whole tennis thing, and it didn't really take long. But we were, I tell people we were one of the, felt like one of the early families to go all in on tennis when it just started to boom back at that point in time. I mean, obviously, people do it all the time now, but back then, it wasn't as crowded as it is today.
Now, when you had a court in your backyard, did they build that for you and your brother, or did your mother like to play and you did it because of that reason?
You know what? That happened in 1979, but yeah, so I was just finishing the 8th grade. But again, my folks played and they used the court, and I maintain to this day it's been the most used backyard tennis court in America.
Yeah. And we'll get into how you're maybe using that now a little later. Well, who coached you growing up? I know Marilyn Roof started you, but was there anybody who stood out kind of as a coach for you?
Yeah, so early on, we started playing at Louisville Tennis Club, founded by the great Don Varga and that group behind Jackie Cooper, who's a legend in his own right. And so my brother actually started taking tennis lessons from Jackie Cooper, and I started taking with Chuck.
Yep.
So we were there for, we played out of Louisville Tennis Club because that was sort of the epicenter of our little tennis colony here in Louisville. But we were, so we took from those guys for some time. But then I worked with Mickey Shad. You probably remember Mickey. I worked with Alan and Mitha.
Right.
There actually was a guy here for a while. He was the pro at Louisville Country Club, and Mockingbird, Charles Benedict was, I think, his name.
Right.
And so that was primarily it. I used to work some with Greg Stevenson when I got older. Greg was always really great about, sure, I'll get out of bed at 6 and and work with you. So.
Well, what strikes me is none of those guys play like you played. I remember your game style as being a big serve, a big forehand, love to come to the net. And those guys were all little baseliners. How did you learn to play the game that you ended up playing, the game style that you ended up playing?
I don't know if it was coached. And I've coached a fair bit of tennis in my day, too. And I, you know, I think how you play in some respects is, you know, it's a reflection of your personality, and you know, I think you play the game the way you think works for you and the way you enjoy playing it, you know, and obviously I think you got to do something that matches your physical skills. So I was fortunate enough that I grew up to be big enough that I could continue to sort of, you know, try to anchor around having a, you know, power aggressive oriented game. But I, you know, maybe I didn't have enough natural speed and stamina. I just didn't want the points to last very long.
Well, you certainly had a great game. Who would you describe as being your junior rivals?
Oh, here locally, it was, you know, Andrew Varga was my peer. We were the same year, and, you know, he had a brother, Paul Varga. And of course, you know, there was a group around my brother's year that were 2 years ahead of me and Andrew. I'd say, so we were, Andrew and I were kind of lucky in that there was quite a few really good players that were just ahead of us. Not as many that were behind us, but, you know, there was Ira Schechter floating around, and you know, even Greg Hill out in Henderson, who went on to be an All-American at Texas A&M.
Right.
He had a young brother that was a little younger, Scott Hill, who was a formidable player back in the day. You know, Paul and Andrew were great players. There was actually, you know, a bunch of girls around town that were also really good players too. Janie Strauss and the Ramsers, and right. You know, a guy named Robbie Urbach, who was a great junior, and early on, you know, Derek Weiss was, I mean, it was actually, if you go back and look in the history books, we had this amazing little group of nationally ranked juniors that played out of Louisville Tennis Club in the, you know, kind of the mid 70s.
Right. And you know, it was a very unique kind of thing because it seemed like you all played with each other and kind of brought each other along as opposed to fought with each other. You know, I know you're very competitive, but it did seem like, you know, I'm being from New Albany, I was familiar with your age group, and it seemed like you all really fed off of each other. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, if you think about 1975, I mean, there was only one quote unquote tennis academy in America. And that was, you know, what Harry Hopman started up at Port Washington at the time where, you know, where John McEnroe grew up. But, you know, we had plenty of coaches around that basically just taught private lessons, and you know, the whole idea of having this big, you know, 30 kids show up at the same time for some junior development clinic, you know, that era didn't start here until I was probably 17 years old. And when we were young, I mean, it was you know, our mom would just drop us off at the tennis club at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and we would just stay there all day long and play tennis with each other. You know, so we played, you know, we played a lot of sets. We didn't do near the amount of drilling that people do today. You know, I've lamented with a lot of kids, like, well, you need to play more sets and do less drilling. But yeah, we competed, but there was definitely some sense that, you know, there was a world outside of just Louisville, and it didn't matter if you were number one in Louisville, if you could, you know, be top 10 in the South.
Right. Before we go into your high school, so where were you in the South and nationally? Where were you in the rankings?
Oh, goodness. I was always floating around top 10, especially my second year in the age group, maybe not first. I think my first year of 18 and under, I think I finished fifth in the South. You know, I was hell bent in my mind that I was going to win Southern Closed, and I for sure was going to win it my first year, 18 and under. And I went down and I think I was seated sixth or seventh, and I lost to a guy named Derry Garner. think he played at Ole Miss in the second round.
Oh my goodness!
And if you think about how college recruiting worked then, you know, and whatnot, you had to finish top 16 in the Southern to get qualified for nationals because it was total complete meritocracy. And I to this day I still maintain that was the best junior tournament I ever had in my life because I after losing the second round I won the consolation. I won 9 matches in a row.
Oh my goodness!
Playing 3 matches a day for 3 days to get to the finals and then win the consolation and you know loads of 3 set matches. But I just think back. You know what? Had I like you know bailed out there? I mean, I wouldn't even have qualified for nationals, and I wouldn't even been on anybody's radar screen.
Right. Well, you know you come through that. And, you know, kind of the culmination of this part of your career was you won back-to-back state high school championships. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you played for Trinity?
I did.
Yeah. What do you remember about any of those state high school tournaments, the finals or the, you know, anything that led up to it? I know one of those finals was played indoors, right?
One of them was played, yeah, you know, I'm trying to think. They actually both might have finished indoors.
Right.
Because it seemed like it rained in the middle of both finals matches, which, you know, seems to happen a fair amount. You know, it's so the state high school tournament is a weird tournament for a lot of people. And you can go back, you can go back and you know, leaf through history and see that in many years, the best players don't win it for right. some reason. And I think about it now, and I know we'll get to that later. You know, it's really the first time in your career as a junior where suddenly you have a whole lot of outside pressure and whatnot in that you're playing for your school, which typically were playing as individuals, you know, and nobody from school even knows what you're doing when you're out playing junior tournaments. And then suddenly the state comes around and you got, you know, 16 of your buddies in the lunchroom that are all down your throat. You're going to win state. You know, I'm sure that happens everywhere. And it adds a wrinkle of pressure, I think, for a lot of people. Or maybe a wrinkle of motivation for others. And historically, it's some weird things have kind of happened. But I will tell you, so I was the beneficiary of being a younger brother.
Right.
I watched my brother struggle 3 times in the state high school tournament. I think he lost in the finals twice.
Oh, my goodness.
And maybe in the semis once. And frankly, you know, if you would ask me on paper, I mean, he had a good chance to win it. You know, each time, I think one time he lost in the finals, he won the first set 6-1, ended up not winning the match. So I guess for me, it was kind of, there was a little bit of me of like, you know, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to show my brother how you get this thing done.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was pretty focused. I tuned everything out. I mean, it was important. In the scheme of things, I mean, it's a great trophy to have and it's something people still talk about and, probably not the most important thing you'll do in a junior tennis career, but it's certainly one of the most noteworthy ones. So I was just really locked in on it and just sort of hell bent for leather on that.
Who did you beat in the finals? Do you remember?
I beat Matt Phones in the finals 1 year, my junior year, who played at Western Kentucky, and I beat Scott Hill in the finals my senior year.
Right.
And the name I didn't mention there, and he and I talk about it because we're still good friends today, is the person I should have been playing in the finals was Andrew Varga.
Uh-huh.
Because I think you go and look at their post-high school careers. Andrew was a hell of a player, and I think he was probably certainly worthy of being in the finals both of those years, and somehow he never wound up there. To this day, I don't understand how that happened. But it happens, you know, because it's a state high school tournament and weird things can happen.
Right. You know, I always thought another big factor with the state high school tournament was the newspapers, especially back in that period, they really covered the tournament. And I thought that added you know, sort of a different sort of pressure to things too.
You know, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, it was a big deal, you know, and I, the Eclipse Award winning thoroughbred writer, Jenny Reese for the Courier Journal, used to be the high school beat writer for high school sports for the Courier Journal back in the day.
Right. Well, you know, now it's time to go to college, and you decide to go to Texas, you know. This, you know, I know how good you were. You know, this was my first recruiting class at Kentucky. And I felt like when we were recruiting you, Gary Plock had a big influence on you going to Texas. Is that fair to say?
So, first of all, I'm going to say you did an awesome job of recruiting me. but Gary Plock had been in my ear since I was 12.
Yes.
Or 13. And that was always kind of, you know, my dream school. And Gary, I'm glad you mentioned Gary. I mean, obviously, he's a legend. But, you know, Gary, we knew the Plocks. And Gary honestly helped my mother navigate our junior tennis careers. She didn't know anything. They didn't know how it all worked. But Gary actually took the time to help her understand, you know, what we needed to do, where we needed to play. You know, if you wanted to leave here and get good coaching, where you need to go to do that. So, yeah, Gary was very influential. He, in fact, you know, he used to come over to this backyard court and work with me in the summers quite a bit. So I had spent a lot of time with Gary. And honestly, I'm not sure Dave Snyder at Texas would have even known who I was if it weren't for Gary probably calling him three times a day.
Well, you know, Texas, very established program, obviously, with a great coach in Dave Snyder. They had had not just Gary, but Gary had played on the team with Kevin Kern and Steve Denton, who later went on to have great, you know, Grand Slam success, reaching finals at Wimbledon and Australia. But you have a great career at Texas. You know, it was a great, great choice for you. And, you know, particularly in doubles, you have this great career. But when did you and Royce Deppe start playing together at Texas?
Yeah, so Royce was from Durban, South Africa. In a bit of tennis trivia here. And Royce, that's where Kevin Curran was from. Royce was actually recruited by Kevin Curran.
Uh-huh.
And Kevin's the one that helped Royce find his way to Texas. I always just thought it was remarkable that a guy from Durban, South Africa and Louisville, Kentucky would, you know, have a replacement team from Durban, South Africa and Louisville, Kentucky, you know, 8 years later.
That's right. I never thought of that.
And unfortunately, you know, Kevin and Gary Plock also lost in the finals NCAAs and doubles. And sadly we matched that record, but maybe that's how it was all meant to be.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so back to your question. So Royce showed up. Royce started in January of my freshman year. So we were the same age.
Gotcha.
You know, came in mid-year from a different hemisphere. And at the time we had four freshmen on the team, and I'll never forget this. Coach, you know, Coach Snyder we spent a lot of time working on doubles, and he took a lot of pride in doubles. And I'll never forget one day he had us come to practice at like 8:30 on a Saturday morning. And I don't think he knew who was going to play doubles together. And I think we played like seven sets of doubles, and each time with a different partner against a different team. And he kept score. And how many games did you win? So he kept the tally of all the individuals and how many games they won. And so at the end of it, he had this tally. And so I don't remember what the exact score was, but I think at the end of the day, Royce and I both were near the top of that game tally list. And then he asked us, you know, who do you want to play with? And I can tell you, you know, for me, and I'm sure it is for most people, I mean, I can tell you within 3 minutes of being on the court with somebody, whether or not we had chemistry. And Royce and I had total chemistry, and I was said, Royce, or, you know, Coach, I want to play with Royce. And My gut says he probably said the same thing. And so we started playing together right out of the gate as freshmen. And we only lost, I think we lost one match our freshman year. He had us playing two. And frankly, we probably should have been playing one, because I don't think we ever lost to Johnny Levine and Tom Fontana in practice, but they were both juniors and obviously well-established good players. But we played two, and we were automatic.
Gosh. Well, you talk about being automatic, and the thing that jumped out to me about your record was you and Depe teamed to win over 100 doubles matches together. And, you know, unfortunately, I think most schools keep records by individually, you know, so, you know, you might have won 100 over 100 matches with Royce, but you also may have won five or six with somebody else, you know, so they add them up that way. Do you know, is that a record at the University of Texas for wins playing with the same partner?
You know, I don't know that. I do know that at one time, and I still may be, that I had won more doubles matches than anybody in school history.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, well, and Royce was up there. I think I just played a few more times than he did with some different people.
Right.
But, yeah, it has to be up there. Because we didn't lose very matches, and you know, you can go back and look at the history books now and see the, you know, winningest all time players, frankly, were guys that I played with, and part of that was because we played so many more matches than what you're allowed to play today.
Correct.
You know, I mean, I think we played 35 dual matches my freshman year.
Yeah, and you probably played a lot more in the fall.
Yep, we did.
You know, I know what you're saying. You know, people seem to be approaching, the college coaches seem to be approaching things differently, as well as the NCAA cut back to where they have that 25 event limit. But, you know, the highlight, and it has to be the highlight, is your sophomore year in 1985, you go to the NCAA final. What do you remember about that run to the NCAA final? Was there a win or two that stood out to you?
I don't remember who we beat in the quarterfinals. I'll tell you what the precursor for that whole thing was, though, is our freshman year playing number two, even though we were damn near undefeated, we didn't get into the tournament.
Right.
Which I think we were an alternate, and we were down there, and we literally, they called us as an alternate to go on the court, and we were literally...
So oh my gosh! Rolls
around, and I think we were both just so disgusted with the fact that we didn't get in that first year, that, you know, we were going to go off on that place, and we put Witskin and Jorge Lozano in the semis, and so, you know, you can look those names up. Those are both, there's a pair that were top 10 in the world, and, you know, big time player, or just, you know, fit to be tied, and then in the finals we played Kelly Jones and Carlos Delora. You know, also both great players. What I remember about that is we lost the first set, and we were up 6-3 in the second set tiebreaker, so three set points, and I served for the set at 6-5. And I remember I hit a decent serve, and I came in and I hit a pretty good volley, but it wasn't close enough. It wasn't directly down the middle. It was more over toward the backhand side. And Delora was a lefty. And just out of the blue, he took a pretty decent volley that I hit and just cold cocked a winner up the line on Royce. That, you know, I to this day, I'm like, you stole my ring from me, you know. Because I felt like we had sort of figured things out and we're about to turn the tables on him, and he pulls this shot out of his rear end.
I bet.
And now, then we end up not winning. And that I still have nightmares about that shot today.
Well, that's great.
It was down in Athens. Yeah.
Let's So you kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, but the Kentucky connections are, and hopefully I have this right, Mel Purcell won an NCAA championship, and then Gary lost in the finals of the NCAAs after beating John McEnroe in the semis. But I think you're one of only three players to reach the NCAA final from the state of Kentucky. Does that sound right to you? Well, you know, you conclude your career at Texas
as a three-time All-American.
Well, he was in singles.
Well, I think you left. That's wrong because you forgot about the boy Eric Quigley.
Yeah, trust me, I never forget Quigley.
Okay, I got you. Right. Okay.
So you conclude your career at Texas as a three-time All-American.
No, none of us will ever forget him.
Accomplished career. As a senior, you finished the year ranked number 3 in doubles and number 43 in singles. You have to be one of the most productive doubles players in the history of that storied program in Texas, who, as you said, took a lot of pride in their doubles. One of the things I noticed during the times that we competed against you, and we did compete against you, you know, we played you all first round of the Volvo All-American that next year after you got to the finals of the NCAA, and then you all came up to Lexington and beat us at the Lexington Tennis Club one time. But one of the things I noticed is that you really seem to have a special relationship with Dave Snyder. Is that true? Is that right? How did he?
That is correct. He's a very special man. Special human. In fact, I've been fortunate enough to get down to Austin here.
How did he help you spend some time with him?
So
you personally,
he's still kicking. Still, he's wonderful. You know, we had such a great, well-organized program, and the practices that we had were super focused and super well-organized. Coach, there were things that I, frankly, as a tennis player, I was, you know, incomplete on with as a junior. You know, I didn't have very good slice backhand. I remember spending hours and hours and hours hitting slice backhand approach shots with Coach. He spent, believe it or not, I didn't really volley that great when I first went to school. We spent gobs of time working on my volleys. But, you know, he embraced who I was as a player and, you know, just sort of built on what it was that I wanted to do. And, you know, and then just put the tools and resources
I think it's fair
and support
to
group out there
you
for us
as
to make
someone
it happen.
Who is uber competitive, and you know, some coaches don't handle that as well as Dave Snyder was able to handle it. How would you describe yourself as a competitor?
Oh, I was, you know, I ran into a teammate of mine with my daughter at the Easter Bowl about 5 years ago, and honestly, this is maybe the biggest compliment anybody's ever paid me. he looked at my daughter and he said, Hey, Carrie, is your dad still the most positive person on the planet? You know, I showed up for practice. I just something clicked in me when I had the opportunity to go play college tennis that I just love tennis. And I just became super focused. And, you know, I went to school, I ate, and I played tennis. And I showed up for practice every day, and I don't think there was ever a bad day. I loved being there, loved every minute of it. And, you know, I was a fighter and a scrapper. I hated to lose. Probably at times I maybe wasn't the greatest sport sometime. But I got there. I matured a bit. And, you know, I know Coach loved that because he knew no matter what, and you as a coach, you know, you got six guys on the team and sometimes somebody doesn't show up with a full tank. And I think coach knew with me, none of the noise around anything ever was going to keep me from going out and competing when the match started. And so I know Coach loved me and told me as much. And part of it was because he knew that he never had to worry about me showing up and being ready to play and ready to give him my all. That I didn't win all the time, but I remember you coming out and going to school at Texas,
and I knew you were going to be a very good college player because one, because of your attitude, two, because you had some weapons, you know, that you were going to be able to hurt people with. But I got to say, you overachieved what I thought you would do in college. And I think that's a great testament to who you are as a competitor. Well,
yeah, I told you, I was an overachiever.
After you conclude your Texas career, you turn pro and you immediately have some success on the pro tour and the challenger level. It seemed like, immediately you went out in 87 and you played with a guy named Mark Basham, who played at UCLA, very good doubles player, kind of a devious little lefty, as I remember him, who moved really well at the net. Is that fair to say you immediately went out and began to have success on the pro tour in 87 and 88 with Basham?
Yeah, I went out. So it actually started before then. So I would go out and play two satellite circuits every summer during college. And so I don't think I've ever seen this written anywhere. So I won four times in the tour challenger series.
Oh my goodness.
But I think I counted up. I won doubles in 16 satellite tournaments.
Right.
You know, playing with a whole bevy of different partners. I remember I won one tournament in Lake Ozarks with John Sobel. I don't know if you remember John Sobel. He played for an Ivy League school. He might have played at Penn or Columbia or something. But I played, and frankly, that's where Mark Basham and I first met. Is we had some success playing satellite circuits out in that old segment four, which ran out in the Midwest, where it's 10,000 degrees. Won a tournament on the satellite, the bluegrass satellite tournament that you had with Greg Hill down in Glasgow. So I started winning doubles right out of college. I mean, right during college. And I think once I started having that level of success in those smaller tournaments, by my sophomore year or beginning of my junior year, I knew I could compete on a world stage on playing doubles.
Well, and building confidence.
I had too much success playing in the minor leagues. It
leads you to your best year on the ATP tour, which was 1989. And in that year you won three challengers in Raleigh, Rio, and Brasilia. You went to the semifinals of the DC tournament, quarterfinals of Boston. But, the highlight had to be going to the finals of the Montreal tournament. Was that considered to be a Masters Series tournament at that time?
It was. That was a big tournament. Wow. I after all these years of reflecting, I never reflected on the fact that all that stuff happened in 89. Yeah, that was a pretty good year.
If there's anything, but, you also go to the third round of the U.S. Open that year. But what do you remember about the Masters Series event up there in Montreal?
So I always loved playing in Canada because it was hard courts and it was never 99 degrees. So it was just a great environment. It was a great week for me. I actually qualified in singles that week too. Qualified and made the main draw singles. So I was playing really good tennis. I was playing with Shelby Cannon, and Shelby and I had made the semis in DC, and we had beaten Mark Witskin and Paul Anacone to get to the semis there. So, big time win on that front. And then we were just playing great tennis. We were both confident. Shelby qualified for singles that week too. I remember he played Andre Agassi in the first round, under the bright lights, and we both were just clicking that week and playing really, really solid tennis. I tell you, I actually have some old video of our of our quarterfinal match there. I wish I had a video of our semifinal match because I felt like we played, felt like I played completely out of my mind that match. It was just great. I mean, we beat Richie Renneberg and Kelly Jones earlier in the tournament. I mean, if you go back through that, I mean,
both of those guys were ranked number one in the world at one point, right, to
get to that point.
Okay. Well, Richie, did he won the U.S.
Kelly
Open
might have been, yeah.
Point,
I don't
though,
remember.
Right? With Grab, did they lose in the finals? Yeah. Well, obviously, you're playing a Masters.
You know what? You may be right about that.
You lose in the finals to Todd Whitkin and Kelly Everenden. So Whitkin, you know, an unbelievable doubles player.
Yes.
I mean, just seemed to be always near the top of the world rankings, like you mentioned. And it didn't seem to matter who he played with. He could play with Lozano. He could play with Paul Anacone. He could play with Everenden. Did you play a lot against Whitkin, or did it just so happen you played Washington and Montreal?
Well, you know, I thought about that match too, because that's one I'd like to have back. So, you know, it's funny how the order of math works sometimes. I played against Todd, I don't know, in between college and pro tennis, 5-6 times maybe.
Right.
And I didn't mind playing against him because he was not somebody that was super overpowering. Like I always felt like was going to get a good look at his serve. And when we played, so we sort of snuck up on him and Paul Anacone in Washington.
Yeah. Well, Charles, you were saying you always felt like you had a good shot when you were playing Whitkin because you got a good look at his serve and he kind of gave you some things. He was just a really talented player.
So I just when I was saying when we played that match up in Canada, we had beaten him 3 weeks prior, and I don't know if he was completely ready for what he got out of Shelby and I, and he showed up and played an amazing match in that final up there. I to this day I'll say he single-handedly beat us. He played amazing. he absolutely played amazing.
Well, later that year and soon after that, you go to the third round of the U.S. Open for the first time. What are your memories about playing in New York in that U.S. Open?
Well, they still had jets flying over back then. So I remember just the noise and the chaos. I loved playing in New York because it was really chaotic environment. And I felt like there was a lot of energy and it was super fun. Playing up there. So yeah, that was those are fond memories from New York there.
Now, did you play with Shelby that tournament?
Yes, that year. Yeah, Shelby and I played together.
Mm-hmm. And then do you remember who you lost to that year?
You know what? I think we lost to Rick Leach and Jim Pugh.
Oh my goodness.
And I think they went on to win the tournament that year.
Yeah. This was just a golden era of people that you played against, you know, because you hate to say it, but all those guys were ranked one in the world, you know, top 10 in the world and had extended careers. Well, you also go to the third round of the U.S. Open in 1991. Who did you play with that year?
So yeah, that was the tandem of overachievers. I was playing that year with a guy named Sven Saluma.
Oh yeah,
that played at IU.
Right.
He might have been a year or two younger than me. I frankly never heard of Sven Saluma in college. I never heard of him in juniors, and Sven was one of these guys that showed up. Out on the satellite circuits a year or two after I got going. And you know, honestly, I don't recall. I sort of recall when he first showed up. He wasn't that strong of a player. And oh my goodness, did that guy turn into a hell of a player to the point where, you know, I think him and Kent Kinnear won the big tournament in Indianapolis. He actually made the semis of the U.S. Open with a guy named Brian Garrow another year, and Sven could just I mean, when he'd like find his groove, he was about 6'5". He could return serve as well as anybody you've ever seen. It was amazing.
Big guy with a great return. Do you remember who you all lost to?
I do. We lost to Anders Järrett and John Fitzgerald.
Wow. Another one of the all-time great teams.
Yeah, another one of my tennis nightmares. That's we were up 4-2 in the third set and didn't win.
Oh, goodness. Against one of the best teams of all time.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that was another one. I think I was down in Australia in the fall, and John Fitzgerald, you know, who's just a prince of a guy, too, he actually went out of his way. He told me, he goes, you were playing so well in New York against us. He goes, it was mind-blowing. You know, he just went out of his way to pay me this compliment. He said, you'd hit your serve, and I would look up, and it felt like you were on my side of the net already. You know, we played a great match, and somehow just, you know, point here, point there, and the next thing you know, I look back, I'm like, well, that's why those guys were number one in the world, because, you know, they just found a gear when they were trapped in an alley and somehow wiggled their way out of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, your career seems to be winding down a little bit more in 92. But you do play Wimbledon for the fifth time, losing the first round. And then you play the French, and you play the mixed doubles at the French, and you lose in the third round. Who did you play with in the mixed, and kind of what are your memories of playing at Wimbledon and the French?
That mixed at the French was fun. I played with a young lady named Claire Wood, who was a British girl. And man, I desperately wanted her to play mixed with me at Wimbledon. And of course she couldn't, because she had to play with another Brit.
Right.
Yeah. But we actually played pretty well together, and she was a pretty good player. You know, so that was fun. Something that's sort of off the radar screen. My fondest memory of Wimbledon, in retrospect, I was not very good on grass. I played mixed doubles there one year with Peanut Louis Harper.
Right.
And we played Steffi Graf and Henri Leconte, and they moved our match. It was the year it rained so much that they played on the middle Sunday for the first time in history.
Right.
So they had not sold tickets for center court, and they just let it open first come, first serve. With the Aaron Krickstein Jimmy Connors match was the last match in there for the day, and they finished, and there was still plenty of daylight left, and the crowd didn't want to leave. They just were screaming and hollering, so they moved our mixed doubles match onto center court at Wimbledon in front of screaming, raucous 10,000, you know, people that couldn't believe they were watching tennis in center court at Wimbledon. And it was, even though we got our butt kicked, it was, I learned a couple things that day. At first it was a total blast, but, you know, I learned Steffi Graf was by far and away at a different level than most of the ladies playing tennis there. And frankly, when you played against Steffi Graf, the other ladies were all scared to death of her. I mean, I think she won half the matches she played just by walking on the court, because they thought, you know, they were afraid of her.
Yeah.
I mean, she was that good.
Yeah.
It's a shame she quit at a relatively young age, because she had a lot more winning left in her.
Yeah. But the back was just so bad, I think, that she had to make a decision, you know, that she wanted to go through what she had to go through to win, because of her back. You reached a career high of 48 on the ATP Tour in doubles. Why did you decide to step away from the game?
Oh, geez. I had been playing for, I don't know, over 5 years. And frankly, I could tell I was starting to get a little tired. You know, it's
obviously I played with a lot of energy and a lot of emotion, and frankly, after, you know, after three sort of nonstop loops around the world, I think I just kind of thought, and you know, I always thought there would be, you know, a life and career after tennis, and I just kind of made the decision that it was probably time. It was never going to be easy to quit a year sooner if I did, or 2 years sooner, that would be better than quitting 2 years too late.
Right.
Just in terms of getting started on another career is so definitely it was, it kind of got to the point where I was sort of dreading going back out on the road again, and I don't want to say dreading going on the court, but at some level I kind of was. And I think at that time, if had I wanted to keep playing, I needed to take 2 months off and just get away from it and go someplace and train and reset and really get super fit again. And I don't know. I just didn't have it in me.
Yeah. Well, did you go immediately into work at Umana when you left the Pro Tour, or did you have?
I didn't. I coached tennis for a year. So uh-huh. I spent a year here in Louisville working almost exclusively with kids. And then I started working down at Umana the first day of 94.
Now, how did you get that job? I mean, did your tennis connections help you with that job?
It did. Actually, I had played or was coaching's father had experience at Humana and flat out said, you know, he said, David Jones loves people like you. Said, you know, if you have any chance of all of getting your resume in front of him, I bet you he'd be interested in. And so that's what happened. I ended up, you know, I sent my resume to directly to him, and within 2 days, his office was on the phone to me with him wanting to take me to lunch.
Yeah, I can imagine. He obviously a wonderful person and who did a lot for the tennis community. Do you feel like your tennis and your competitiveness and those things, have they helped you in your position at Umana?
Oh, absolutely. You know, because the tennis, you know, well, first of all, being competitive, you know, means, you know, in work, it means you sort of take pride and stuff. And, you know, even though it's different, you know, I'm still competitive, and, you know, my teams that I have at Humana, I remind them sometimes, hey, folks, we we always have to be first, you know, but just kind of the way you're wired and it makes you so resilient, you know, it's helped me to be patient in my career and you know, but let's face it. I mean, you know, tennis is an emotionally charged world where you have extreme highs and lows and anguish and celebration. And, you know, you don't get all that. You don't get all that in the corporate world. I mean, people are calmer and steadier, but, you know, I think at the same time, all those underlying skills and, you know, emotional skills you learn playing pro sports helps you in the work world.
Yeah. Let's take you back to the backyard court here as we finish up. Now you've got your own daughter, and she reminds me very much of you in her game style and in her attitude. How much do you work with Carrie? And you know, just so the listeners know, she's a 2-time state high school finalist who would have been favored to win her third last year and lost it that year due to COVID. And then she's the favorite to win it again this year. But how much do you work with Carrie and how do you feel like you've helped her?
So I've worked with Carrie a lot through the years, although I would not say I've been her primary coach. So look, you know, having a daughter that sort of voluntarily says, "Hey, I want to go. I want to go rerun this route that you ran." And I told her when she was young, and she seemed to think she wanted to really go after it. I just said, "Look, you know, I'll do this, and I'll support you, and I'll, you know, and stand by you, but and I'll work with you, and I'll help you." I said, "But I need you to know that if you're doing this because you think I want you to do it, then that's going to be a problem." I said, "Because it's too painful. And, you know, if you want to do it, you have to want to do it. You have to love it. You can't love it because you think your dad loves it." And I was pretty upfront about that. And frankly, I think she does. And so that's kind of how we all started. And kind of the other thing was, I said, "And you know what? I'm not going to come watch you play all the time because I'm going to have to work. And oh, by the way, you know, you need to go out and do this stuff on your own. You don't need to be playing because you think your dad's watching you." So that's so all that's worked pretty well, you know. And from a style of play perspective, you know, she always wanted to be aggressive. She's a good athlete. And, you know, early on when I work with her, you know, I mean, one thing you have to learn how to do, and maybe this is me sort of having been through the ringer, is, you know, you mentioned it, you got to have weapons. So when she was just a young buck, I would tell her, "I want you to hit it as hard as you can. I don't care. As long as it's not going over the fence, you don't have to worry about it being in. You just need to start hitting it hard, and you need to get comfortable hitting it hard, and you need to not fear hitting it hard." And we would work on that. So when she was, you know, 9, 10 years old, you know, I would feed her balls with no pace and tell her to rip them. You know, keep your technique in order. But I know that was a little different, and maybe I paid a price at some point in time for some of that. But I know some guys in my boat, you know, taught their kids to, you know, hit 1,000 balls in a row before, you know, and then you end up with a different problem. So you either sort of coach somebody to be aggressive to begin with and hope you can add consistency later, or coach them to be consistent and hope you can add power later.
Right. Right. Well, it's just a different perspective when you've played on the pro tour and you know what it takes to play out there. And I know Carrie has aspirations of playing out there on the pro tour. You know, my two thoughts are, I hope I live long enough to do a podcast of Carrie as a Hall of Famer, because I think she's certainly headed that direction. I don't know how many father-daughter Hall of Fame there are, but there can't be that many in the KTA. But I see you and her, but do you see you and her?
In some ways she's a little different than me. She tends to think a lot more than I think. And, you know, I sort of just, you know, turn your brain off and let your body run the show out here. And, but some of it, I think and times have changed. So maybe this is an unfair statement, but I do kind of feel like the young ladies have a little more anguish about all of it, you know. Time great, you know, Serena Williams, seeing her, you know, several years ago up in the semis Australian Open, you know, very anxious about her play and affecting her play. And so, you know, I've just tried to just tell her to focus on just play your best and don't worry about the result. You're gonna lose. I mean, you know, we all lose lots of matches. You know, take and enjoy the ride and play the way you want to play, have fun with it, and Don't focus on the result as much. And sometimes I think she's focused a little bit too much on the result or whatnot, but we're working on that. And that's a growth process. I mean, I probably had a different variant of the same kind of emotion, but you know, I probably yelled and screamed a lot.
Yeah. Well, let's finish this up here. With and by the way, congratulations on all her success, because I think the state high school is one of the really great events that tennis players can play. It's something that I've always tried to emphasize, like with my son, you know, look, this is something you want to win. And, you know, when players tell me, you know, look, I don't think I'm going to play the state high school, I want to say, you've got to be kidding me. You know, it's one of the great experiences that you can have. So congratulations on all her success.
Well, I tell you, it was very special having her get her two titles and for me to see her fall into my shoes. And I hope she can squeak out another one. And of course the old COVID thing last year, that just kind of stunk for everybody.
Yeah. Well, I think there's only been one female player to win 4 state championships consecutively. And there's been a lot of great players, you know, from Susan Sloan to Caroline Kuhlman, you know, Jackie Trail, Julie Diddy, but to win 4 would be really special. And so you really hate the COVID thing. My last question for you is, what does it mean to you to be a member of the Kentucky Tennis Hall of Fame? What makes that special to you?
Oh, geez, you know, it's just great to be recognized. I mean, I'm far removed from tennis today, and you know, with a corporate career and all that, and frankly, have gone out of my way to never really talk about tennis at work and whatnot, and. You know, having that honor, you know, bestowed upon me certainly is sort of rekindled a lot of great feelings about tennis. And, you know, it's amazing how many people come up to me at work and say, oh, my gosh, I saw your picture hanging on the wall. And, you know, people that maybe didn't even know I played tennis.
Right.
You know, so it's great. I mean, look, you know, you put a lot into your life's work, and funny thing is I I don't talk a lot about tennis at work. I really don't, but I deep down in my heart of hearts, I still consider myself more of a tennis player than anything else. you know, but it's wonderful to be there and see those other great people up there. And, you know, our sport has such a great history, you know, and to be part of all that history. And, you know, even the years that I played, you know, you mentioned all the folks I played. I just, you know, I had the opportunity to play against just all kinds of people that are part of tennis history, and just being there and having that recognition makes you feel good about things.
Well, Charles, listen, thanks for taking the time to do this with us. We really appreciate it and look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dennis.